historical and psychological time, and sometimes even mortality. Not that this state of mind doesn't have its drawbacks. To name one, other people cease to matter. Yet this thoroughgoing absorption in the present is, as both Eastern and Western religious traditions tell us, as close as we mortals ever get to an experience of eternity. Boethius, the 6th century Neoplatonist, said the goal of our spiritual striving was to hold and possess the whole fullness of life in one moment, here and now, past and present and to come. Likewise in the Eastern tradition, awakening to this present instant, a Zen master has written, we realize the infinite is in the finite of each instant. Yet we can't get there from here without first forgetting. I am not by nature one of the world's great noticers. Unless I make a conscious effort, I won't notice what color your shirt is, the song playing on the radio, or whether you put one sugar in your coffee or two. When I'm working as a reporter, I have to hector myself continually to mark the details. Checked shirt, two sugars, Van Morrison. Why this should be so, I have no idea, except that I am literally absent-minded, prone to be thinking about something else, something past, when I am ostensibly having a fresh experience. Almost always, my attention can't wait to beat a retreat from the here and now to the abstract, frog jumping from the data of the senses to conclusions. Actually, it's worse than that. Very often the conclusions or concepts come first, allowing me to dispense with the sensory data altogether or to notice in it only what fits. It's a form of impatience with lived life, and though it might appear to be a symptom of an active mind, I suspect it's really a form of laziness. My lawyer father, once complimented on his ability to see ahead 3 or 4 moves in a negotiation, explained that the reason he liked to jump to conclusions was so he could get there early and rest. I'm the same way in my negotiations with reality. Though I suspect that what I have is only an acute case of an attention disorder that is more or less universal. Seeing, hearing, smelling, feeling, or tasting things as they really are is always difficult, if not impossible, in part because doing so would overwhelm us, as George Eliot understood. So we perceive each multisensory moment through a protective screen of ideas, past experiences, or expectations. Nature always wears the colors of the spirit, Emerson wrote, by which he meant we never see the world plainly, only through the filter of prior concepts or metaphors. Colors, in classical rhetoric, are tropes. In my case, this filter is so fine, or is it thick, that a lot of the details and textures of reality simply never get through. It's a habit of mind I sorely wish I could break, since it keeps me from enjoying the pleasures of the senses and the moment, pleasures that, at least in the abstract, I prize above all others. But right there, you see the problem. In the abstract. All those who write about cannabis's effect on consciousness speak of the changes in perception they experience, and specifically of an intensification of all the senses. Common foods taste better. Familiar music is suddenly sublime. Sexual touch revelatory. Scientists who've studied the phenomenon can find no quantifiable change in the visual, auditory, or tactile acuity of subjects high on marijuana, yet these people invariably report seeing and hearing and tasting things with a new keenness, as if with fresh eyes and ears and taste buds. You know how it goes. This italicization of experience, this seemingly virginal noticing of the sensate world. You've heard that song 1,000 times before, but now you suddenly hear it in all its soul-piercing beauty, the sweet, bottomless poignancy of the guitar line like a revelation, and for the first time you can understand, really understand, just what Jerry Garcia meant by every note, his unhurried, cheerful, baleful improvisation piping something very near the meaning of life directly into your mind. Or that exceptionally delicious spoonful of vanilla ice cream. Ice cream, parting the drab curtains of the quotidian to reveal, what? The heart-rendingly sweet significance of cream, yes, bearing us all the way back to the breast. Not to mention the never-before-adequately appreciated wonder of vanilla. How astonishing is it that we happen to inhabit a universe in which this quality of vanilliness, this bean, happens also to reside? How easily it could have been otherwise, and just where would we be, where would chocolate be, without that singular irreplaceable note, that middle C on the scale of archetypal flavors? Paging Dr. Plato. For the first time in your journey on this planet, you are fully appreciating vanilla in all its italicized and capitalized significance. Until, that is, the next epiphany comes along. Chairs. People thinking in other languages. Carbonated water. And the one about ice cream is blown away like a leaf on the breeze of free association. Nothing is easier to make fun of than these pot-sponsored perceptions, long the broad butt of jokes about marijuana. But I'm not prepared to concede that these epiphanies are as empty or false as they usually appear in the cold light of the next day. In fact, I'm tempted to agree with Carl Sagan, who is convinced that marijuana's morning-after problem is not a question of self-deception so much as a failure to communicate. To put these insights in a form acceptable to the quite different self that we are when we're down the next day. We simply don't have the words to convey the force of these perceptions to our straight selves, perhaps because they are the kinds of perceptions that precede words. They may well be banal, but that doesn't mean they aren't also, at the same time, profound. Marijuana dissolves this apparent contradiction, and it does so by making us temporarily forget most of the baggage we usually bring to our perception of something like ice cream, our acquired sense of its familiarity and banality. For what is a sense of the banality of something if not a defense against the overwhelming, or at least whelming, power of that thing experienced freshly? Banality depends on memory, as do irony and abstraction and boredom, three other defenses the educated mind deploys against experience so that it can get through the day without being continually, exhaustingly astonished. It is by temporarily mislaying much of what we already know, or think we know, that cannabis restores a kind of innocence to our perceptions of the world. And innocence in adults will always flirt with embarrassment. The cannabinoids are molecules with the power to make romantics and transcendentalists of us all. By disabling our moment-by-moment memory, which is ever pulling us off the astounding frontier of the present and throwing us back onto the mapped byways of the past, the cannabinoids open a space for something nearer to direct experience. By the grace of this forgetting, we temporarily shelve our inherited ways of looking and see things as if for the first time, so that even something as ordinary as ice cream becomes ice cream. There is another word for this extremist noticing, this sense of first sight unencumbered by knowingness, by the already been-theres and seen-thats of the adult mind. And that word, of course, is wonder. Memory is the enemy of wonder, which abides nowhere else but in the present. This is why, unless you are a child, wonder depends on forgetting, on a process, that is, of subtraction. Ordinarily, we think of drug experiences as additive. It's often said that drugs distort normal perceptions and augment the data of the senses, adding hallucinations, say. But it may be that the very opposite is true. That they work by subtracting some of the filters that consciousness normally interposes between us and the world. This, at least, was Aldous Huxley's conclusion in The Doors of Perception, his 1954 account of his experiments with mescaline. In Huxley's view, the drug, which is derived from peyote, the flower of a desert cactus, disables what he called the reducing valve of consciousness. His name for the conscious mind's everyday editing faculty. The reducing valve keeps us from being crushed under the pressure of reality, But it accomplishes this at a price, for the mechanism prevents us from ever seeing reality as it really is. The insight of mystics and artists flows from their special ability to switch off the mind's reducing valve. I'm not sure any of us ever perceives reality as it really is. How would one know? But Huxley is persuasive in depicting wonder as what happens when we succeed in suspending our customary verbal and conceptual ways of seeing. He writes with a wacky earnestness about the beauty of fabric folds, a garden chair, and a vase of flowers. I was seeing what Adam had seen on the morning of his creation, the miracle, moment by moment, of naked existence. I think I understand Huxley's reducing valve of consciousness, though in my own experience the mechanism looks a little different. I picture ordinary consciousness more as a funnel, or, even better, as the cinched waist of an hourglass. In this metaphor, the mind's eye stands poised between time past and time to come, determining which of the innumerable grains of sensory experience will pass through the narrow aperture of the present and enter into memory. I know, there are some problems with this metaphor, the main one being that all the sand eventually gets to the bottom of an hourglass, whereas most of the grains of experience never make it past our regard. But the metaphor at least gets at the notion that the principal work of consciousness is eliminative and defensive, maintaining perceptual order to keep us from being overwhelmed. So, what happens under the influence of drugs, or, for that matter, inspiration? In Huxley's metaphor, the reducing valve is opened wide to admit more of experience. This seems about right, though I'd qualify it by suggesting, as Huxley's own examples do, that the effect of altered consciousness is to admit a whole lot more information about a much smaller increment of experience. The folds of my gray flannel trousers were charged with isness, Huxley tells us, before dilating on Botticelli draperies and the allness and infinity of folded cloth. The usual process by which the grains of perception pass us by slows way down, to the point where the conscious eye can behold each grain in its turn, scrupulously examining it from every conceivable angle. Sometimes from more angles than it even has, until all there is the still point at the hourglass's waist, where time itself appears to pause. But is this wonder the real thing? At first glance, it wouldn't seem to be. A transcendence that's chemically induced must surely be fake. Artificial Paradises was what Charles Baudelaire called his 1860 book about his experiences with hashish, and that sounds about right. Yet what if it turns out that the neurochemistry of transcendence is no different whether you smoke marijuana, meditate, or enter a hypnotic trance by way of chanting, fasting, or prayer? What if in every one of these endeavors, the brain is simply prompted to produce large quantities of cannabinoids, thereby suspending short-term memory and allowing us to experience the present deeply? There are many technologies for changing the brain's chemistry. Drugs may simply be the most direct. This doesn't necessarily make drugs a better technology for changing consciousness. Indeed, the toxic side effects of so many of them suggest that the opposite is true. From a brain's point of view, the distinction between a natural and an artificial high may be meaningless. Aldous Huxley did his best to argue us out of the view that a chemically conditioned spiritual experience is false, and he did so long before we knew anything about cannabinoid or opioid receptor networks. In one way or another, all our experiences are chemically conditioned, and if we imagine that some of them are purely spiritual, purely intellectual, purely aesthetic, it is merely because we have never troubled to investigate the internal chemical environment at the moment of their occurrence. He points out that mystics have always worked systematically to modify their brain chemistry, whether through fasting, self-flagellation, sleeplessness, hypnotic movement, or chanting. Huxley suggests that the reason there aren't nearly as many mystics and visionaries walking around today as compared to the Middle Ages is the improvement in nutrition. Vitamin deficiencies wreak havoc on brain function and probably explain a large portion of visionary experiences in the past. The brain can be made to drug itself, as seems to happen with certain placebos. We don't merely imagine that the placebo antidepressant is working to lift our sadness or worry. The brain is actually producing extra serotonin in response to the mental prompt of swallowing a pill containing nothing but sugar and belief. What all this suggests is that the workings of consciousness are both more and less materialistic than we usually think. Chemical reactions can induce thoughts, but thoughts can also induce chemical reactions. Even so, the use of drugs for spiritual purposes feels cheap and false. Perhaps it is our work ethic that is offended. You know, no pain, no gain. Or maybe it is the provenance of the chemicals that troubles us, the fact that they come from outside. Especially in the Judeo-Christian West, we tend to define ourselves by the distance we've put between ourselves and nature, and we jealously guard the borders between matter and spirit as proof of our ties to the angels. The notion that spirit might turn out in some sense to be matter, and plant matter no less, is a threat to our sense of separateness and godliness. Spiritual knowledge comes from above or within, but surely not from plants. Christians have a name for someone who believes otherwise. Pagan. Two stories stand behind the taboos that people in the West have placed on cannabis at various times in its history. Each reflects our anxieties about this remarkable plant, about what its Dionysian power might do to us if it is not resisted or brought under control. The first, brought back from the Orient by Marco Polo, among others, is the story of the assassins, or rather, a corruption of the story of the assassins, which may or may not be apocryphal to begin with. The time is the 11th century, when a vicious sect called the Assassins, under the absolute control of Hassan ibn al-Sabah, a.k.a. the Old Man of the Mountain, is terrorizing Persia, robbing and murdering with brutal abandon. Hassan's marauders will do anything he tells them to, no questions asked. They have lost their fear of death. How does Hassan secure this perfect loyalty? By treating his men to a foretaste of the eternal paradise that will be theirs should they die in his service. Hassan would begin his initiation of new recruits by giving them so much hashish that they passed out. Hours later, the men would awaken to find themselves in the midst of a most beautiful palace garden, laid with sumptuous delicacies and staffed with gorgeous maidens to gratify their every desire. Scattered through this paradise, lying on the ground in pools of blood, are severed heads. Actually, actors buried to their necks. The heads speak, telling the men of the afterlife and what they will have to do if they hope ever to return to this paradise. The story was corrupted by the time Marco Polo retold it, so that the hashish was now directly responsible for the violence of the assassins. The word itself is a corruption of hashish. By erasing the assassins' fear of death, the story suggested, hashish freed them to commit the most daring and merciless crimes. The tale became a staple of Orientalism and later of the campaign to criminalize marijuana in America in the 1930s. Harry J. Anslinger, the first director of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics and the man most responsible for marijuana prohibition, mentioned the assassins at every opportunity. He skillfully used this meta-narrative, publicizing every contemporary crime story he could cut to its lurid pattern, to transform a little-known drug of indolence into one of violence, a social menace. Even after Anslinger's reefer madness had subsided, the moral of the tale of the assassins continued to trail cannabis, the notion that by severing the link between acts and their consequences, marijuana unleashes human inhibitions, thereby endangering Western civilization. The second story is simply this. In 1484, Pope Innocent VIII issued a papal condemnation of witchcraft in which he specifically condemned the use of cannabis as an anti-sacrament in satanic worship. The Black Mass, celebrated by medieval witches and sorcerers, presented a mocking mirror image of the Catholic Eucharist, and in it, cannabis traditionally took the place of wine, serving as a pagan sacrament in a counterculture that sought to undermine the establishment church. The fact that witches and sorcerers were the first Europeans to exploit the psychoactive properties of cannabis probably sealed its fate in the West as a drug identified with feared outsiders and cultures conceived in opposition: pagans, Africans, hippies. The two stories fed each other and, in turn, the plant's power. People who smoked cannabis were other, and the cannabis they smoked threatened to let their otherness loose in the land. Witches the church simply burned at the stake, but something more interesting happened to the witches' magic plants. The plants were too precious to banish from human society, so in the decades after Pope Innocent's fiat against witchcraft, cannabis, opium, belladonna, and the rest were simply transferred from the realm of sorcery to medicine, thanks largely to the work of a 16th-century Swiss alchemist and physician named Paracelsus. Sometimes called the father of medicine, Paracelsus established a legitimate pharmacology largely on the basis of the ingredients found in flying ointments. Among his many accomplishments was the invention of laudanum, the tincture of opium that was perhaps the most important drug in the pharmacopoeia until the 20th century. Paracelsus often said that he had learned everything he knew about medicine from the sorceresses. Working under the rational sign of Apollo, he domesticated their forbidden Dionysian knowledge, turning the pagan potions into healing tinctures, bottling the magic plants, and calling them medicines. Paracelsus's grand project, which arguably is still going on today, represents one of the many ways the Judeo-Christian tradition has deployed its genius to absorb or co-opt the power of the pagan faith it set out to uproot. In much the same way that the new monotheism folded into its rituals the people's traditional pagan holidays and spectacles, it desperately needed to do something about their ancient devotion to magic plants. Indeed, the story of the forbidden fruit in Genesis suggests that nothing was more important. The challenge these plants posed to monotheism was profound, for they threatened to divert people's gaze from the sky, where the new god resided, down to the natural world all around them. The magic plants were, and remain, a gravitational force pulling us back to earth, to matter, away from the there and then of Christian salvation, and back to the here and now. Indeed, what these plants do to time is perhaps the most dangerous thing about them. Dangerous, that is, from the perspective of a civilization organized on the lines of Christianity and, more recently, capitalism. Christianity and capitalism are both probably right to detest a plant like cannabis. Both faiths bid us to set our sights on the future. Both reject the pleasures of the moment and the senses in favor of the expectation of a fulfillment yet to come, whether by earning salvation or by getting and spending. More even than most plant drugs, cannabis, by immersing us in the present and offering something like fulfillment here and now, short-circuits the metaphysics of desire on which Christianity and capitalism, and so much else in our civilization, depend. David Lenson draws a useful distinction between drugs of desire, cocaine, for example, and drugs of pleasure, such as cannabis. Cocaine promises the greatest pleasure ever known in just a minute more, but that future never comes. In this respect, the cocaine experience is a savage mimicry of consumer consciousness. With cannabis or the psychedelics, on the other hand, pleasure can come from natural beauty, domestic tasks, friends and relatives, conversation, or any number of objects that do not need to be purchased. What, then, was the knowledge that God wanted to keep from Adam and Eve in the garden? Theologians will debate this question without end, but it seems to me the most important answer is hidden in plain sight. The content of the knowledge Adam and Eve could gain by tasting of the fruit does not matter nearly as much as its form. That is, the very fact that there was spiritual knowledge of any kind to be had from a tree, from nature. The new faith sought to break the human bond with magic nature, to disenchant the world of plants and animals by directing our attention to a single God in the sky. Yet Jehovah couldn't very well pretend the tree of knowledge didn't exist, not when generations of plant-worshipping pagans knew better. So the pagan tree is allowed to grow even in Eden, though ringed around now with a strong taboo. Yes, there is spiritual knowledge in nature, the new God is acknowledging, and its temptations are fierce, but I am fiercer still. Yield to it, and you will be punished. So unfolds the drug war's first battle. I've removed most all of the temptations from my own garden, though not without regret or protest. Immersed this spring in research for this chapter, I was sorely tempted to plant one of the hybrid cannabis seeds I'd seen for sale in Amsterdam. I immediately thought better of it, however. So I planted lots of opium poppies instead. I hasten to add that I've no plans to do anything with my poppies except admire them. First their fleeting tissue paper blooms, then their swelling blue-green seed pods, fat with milky alkaloid. Unless, of course, simply walking among the poppies is enough to have an effect, as it was for Dorothy in Oz. Unscored and so at least arguably innocent, these poppies are my stand-ins for the cannabis I cannot plant. Whenever I look at their dreamy petals, I'll be reminded of the powers this garden has abjured in order to stay on the safe side of the law. So I make do with this bowdlerized garden, this densely planted plot of acceptable pleasures. Good things to eat, beautiful things to gaze upon, fenced around by heated laws. If Dionysus is represented in this garden, and he surely is, it's mainly in the flower border. I would be the last person to make light of the power of a fragrant rose to raise one's spirits, summon memories, even, in some not merely metaphorical sense, to intoxicate. The garden is a place of many sacraments, an arena at once as common as any room and as special as a church, where we can go not just to witness, but to enact in a ritual way our abiding ties to the natural world. Abiding, yet by now badly attenuated, for civilization seems bent on breaking or at least forgetting our connections to the earth. But in the garden, the old bonds are preserved, and not merely as symbols. So we eat from the vegetable patch, and, if we're paying attention, we're recalled to our dependence on the sun and the rain and the everyday leaf-by-leaf alchemy we call photosynthesis. Likewise, the poultice of comfrey leaves that lifts a wasp's sting from our skin returns us to a quasi-magic world of healing plants from which modern medicine would cast us out. Such sacraments are so benign that few of us have any trouble embracing them, even if they do sound a faintly pagan note. I guess that's because we're generally willing to be reminded that our bodies, at least, remain linked in such ways to the world of plants and animals, to nature's cycles. But what about our minds? Here we're not so sure anymore. To take a leaf or flower and use it to change our experience of consciousness suggests a very different sort of sacrament, one at odds with our loftier notions of self, not to mention civilized society. But I'm inclined to think that such a sacrament may on occasion be worthwhile just the same, if only as a check on our hubris. Plants with the power to revise our thoughts and perceptions, to provoke metaphor and wonder, challenge the cherished Judeo-Christian belief that our conscious thinking selves somehow stand apart from nature, have achieved a kind of transcendence. Just what happens to this flattering self-portrait if we discover that transcendence itself owes to molecules that flow through our brains and at the same time through the plants in the garden? If some of the brightest fruits of human culture are, in fact, rooted deeply in this black earth, with the plants and fungi. Is matter, then, still as mute as we've come to think? Does it mean that spirit, too, is part of nature? There may be no older idea in the world. Friedrich Nietzsche once described Dionysian intoxication as nature overpowering mind, nature having her way with us. The Greeks understood that this was not something to be undertaken lightly or too often. Intoxication was a carefully circumscribed ritual for them, never a way to live, because they understood that Dionysus can make angels of us or animals. It all depends. Even so, letting nature have her way with us now and again still seems like a useful thing to do, if only to bring our abstracted upward gaze back down to earth for a time. What a re-enchantment of the world that would be, to look around and see that the plants and the trees of knowledge grow in the garden still. Chapter 4. Desire, Control. Plant, the potato. Solanum tuberosum. To my eye, there are few sights in nature quite as stirring as fresh rows of vegetable seedlings rising like a green city on the spring ground. I love the on-off digital rhythm of new green plant and black-turned loam, the geometrical ordering of bounded earth that is the vegetable garden in May, before the plagues, before the rampancy, before the daunting complexities of summer. The sublimities of wilderness have their place, okay, and their legions of American poets, God knows, but I want to speak a word here for the satisfactions of the ordered earth. I'd call it the agricultural sublime if that didn't sound too much like an oxymoron, which it probably is. The experience of the sublime is all about nature having her way with us, about the sensation of awe before her power, about feeling small. What I'm talking about is the opposite, and admittedly more dubious, satisfaction of having our way with nature. The pleasure of beholding the reflection of our labor and intelligence in the land. In the same way that Niagara or Everest stirs the first impulse, the farmer's methodical rows stitching the hills, or the allee of pollarded trees ordering a garden like Versailles, excite the second, filling us with a sense of our power. These days, the sublime is mostly a kind of vacation, in both a literal and a moral sense. After all, who has a bad word to say about wilderness anymore? By comparison, this other impulse, the desire to exert our control over nature's wildness, bristles with ambiguity. We're unsure about our power in nature, its legitimacy, and its reality, and rightly so. Perhaps more than most, the farmer or the gardener understands that his control is always something of a fiction, depending as it does on luck and weather and much else that is beyond his control. It is only the suspension of disbelief that allows him to plant again every spring, to wade out in the season's uncertainties. Before long, the pests will come, the storms and droughts and blights, as if to remind him just how imperfect the human power implied by those pristine rows really is. In 1999, a freak December windstorm, more powerful than any Europeans could remember, laid waste to many of André Lenôtre's centuries-old plantings at Versailles, crumpling in a matter of seconds that garden's perfect geometries, perhaps as potent an image of human mastery as we have. When I saw the pictures of the wrecked allées, the straight lines scrabbled, the painterly perspectives ruined, it occurred to me that a less emphatically ordered garden would have been better able to withstand the storm's fury and repair itself afterward. So, what are we to make of such a disaster? It all depends on whether one regards that particular storm as a straightforward proof of our hubris and nature's infinitely superior power, or, as some scientists now do, as an effect of global warming, which is adding to the atmosphere's instability. In that view, the storm is as much a human artifact as the order of trees it shattered, one manifestation of human power pulling the rug out from under another. Ironies of this kind are second nature to the gardener, who eventually learns that every advance in his control of the garden is also an invitation to a new disorder. Wilderness might be reducible acre by acre, but wildness is something else again. So the freshly hoed earth invites a new crop of weeds. The potent new pesticide engenders resistance in pests, and every new step in the direction of simplification, toward monoculture, say, or genetically identical plants, leads to unimagined new complexities. Yet these simplifications are undeniably powerful. Often as not, they work. Get us what we want from nature. Agriculture is, by its very nature, brutally reductive, simplifying nature's incomprehensible complexity to something humanly manageable. It begins, after all, with the simple act of banishing all but a tiny handful of chosen species. Planting these in intelligible rows not only flatters our sense of order, it makes good sense, too. Weeding and harvesting become that much simpler. And though nature herself never plants in rows, or parterres, or allées, she doesn't necessarily begrudge us when we do. In fact, lots of new things happen in the garden, novelties unknown in nature before our attempts to exert control. Edible potatoes. The wild ones are too bitter and toxic to eat. Doubled tulips, sensimilla, nectarines, to name a few. In every case, nature supplied the necessary genes or mutations, but without the garden and the gardener to make a space for these novelties, they would never have seen the light of day. For nature as much as for people, the garden has always been a place to experiment, to try out new hybrids and mutations. Species that never cross in the wild will freely hybridize on land cleared by people. That's because a novel hybrid has a hard time finding a purchase in the tight weave of an established meadow or forest ecosystem. Every possible niche is apt to be already filled. But a garden, or a roadside, or a dump heap, is by comparison an open habitat in which a new hybrid has a much better shot, and if it happens to catch our fancy, to gratify a human desire, it stands to make its way in the world. One theory of the origins of agriculture holds that domesticated plants first emerged on dump heaps, where the discarded seeds of the wild plants that people gathered and ate, already unconsciously selected for sweetness or size or power, took root, flourished, and eventually hybridized. In time, people gave the best of these hybrids a place in the garden, and there, together, the people and the plants embarked on a series of experiments in coevolution that would change them both forever. The garden is still a site for experiment, a good place to try out new plants and techniques without having to bet the farm. Many of the methods employed by organic farmers today were first discovered in the garden. Attempted on the scale of a whole farm, the next new thing is an expensive and risky proposition, which is why farmers have always been a conservative breed, notoriously slow to change. But for a gardener like me, with relatively little at stake, it's no big deal to try out a new variety of potato or method of pest control, and every season I do. Admittedly, my experiments in the garden are unscientific and far from foolproof or conclusive. Is it the new neem tree oil I sprayed on the potatoes that's controlling the beetles so well this year? Or the fact I planted a pair of tomatillos nearby, the leaves of which the beetles seem to prefer to potatoes? My scapegoats, I call them. Ideally, I'd control for every variable but one. But that's hard to do in a garden. A place that, like the rest of nature, seems to consist of nothing but variables. Everything affecting everything else is not a bad description of what happens in a garden or, for that matter, in any ecosystem. In spite of these complexities, it is only by trial and error that my garden ever improves, so I continue to experiment. Recently I planted something new. Something very new, as a matter of fact, and embarked on my most ambitious experiment to date, I planted a potato called New Leaf that has been genetically engineered by the Monsanto Corporation to produce its own insecticide. This it does in every cell of every leaf, stem, flower, root, and, this is the unsettling part, every spud. The scourge of potatoes has always been the Colorado potato beetle, a handsome, voracious insect that can pick a plant clean of its leaves virtually overnight, starving the tubers in the process. Supposedly, any Colorado potato beetle that takes so much as a nibble of a new leaf is doomed, its digestive tract pulped, in effect, by the bacterial toxin manufactured in every part of these plants. I wasn't at all sure I really wanted the new leaf potatoes I'd be digging at the end of the season. In this respect, my experiment in growing them was very different from anything else I've ever done in my garden, whether growing apples or tulips or even pot. All of those I'd planted because I really wanted what the plants promised. What I wanted here was to gratify not so much a desire as a curiosity. Do they work? Are these genetically modified potatoes a good idea, either to plant or to eat? If not mine, then whose desire do they gratify? And finally, what might they have to tell us about the future of the relationship between plants and people? To answer these questions, or at least begin to, would take more than the tools of the gardener or the eater. I'd need as well the tools of the journalist, without which I couldn't hope to enter the world from which these potatoes had come. So you could say there was something fundamentally artificial about my experiment in growing new leaf potatoes. But then, artificiality seems very much to the point. Certainly my new leaves are aptly named. They're part of a new class of crop plant that is transforming the long, complex, and by now largely invisible food chain that links every one of us to the land. By the time I conducted my experiment, more than 50 million acres of American farmland had already been planted to genetically modified crops, most of it corn, soybeans, cotton, and potatoes that have been engineered either to produce their own pesticide or to withstand herbicides. The not-so-distant future will, we're told, bring us potatoes genetically modified to absorb less fat when fried, corn that can withstand drought, lawns that don't ever have to be mowed, golden rice rich in vitamin A, bananas and potatoes that deliver vaccines, tomatoes enhanced with flounder genes to withstand frost, and cotton that grows in every color of the rainbow. It's probably not too much to say that this new technology represents the biggest change in the terms of our relationship with plants since people first learned how to cross one plant with another. With genetic engineering, human control of nature is taking a giant step forward. The kind of reordering of nature represented by the rows in a farmer's field can now take place at a whole new level, within the genome of the plants themselves. Truly, we have stepped out onto new ground. Or have we? Just how novel these plants really are is, in fact, one of the biggest questions about them, and the companies that have developed them give contradictory answers. The industry simultaneously depicts these plants as the linchpins of a biological revolution, part of a paradigm shift that will make agriculture more sustainable and feed the world, and, oddly enough, as the same old spuds, corn and soybeans, at least so far as those of us at the eating end of the food chain should be concerned. The new plants are novel enough to be patented, yet not so novel as to warrant a label telling us what it is we're eating. It would seem they are chimeras. Revolutionary in the patent office and on the farm, nothing new in the supermarket and the environment. By planting my own crop of new leaves, I was hoping to figure out which version of reality to believe, whether these were indeed the same old spuds or something sufficiently novel, in nature, in the diet, to warrant caution and hard questions. As soon as you start looking into the subject, you find that there are many questions about genetically modified plants that, 50 million acres later, remain unanswered and, more remarkable still, unasked. Enough to make me think, mine might not be the only experiment going on. May 2nd. Here at the planter's end of the food chain, where I began my experiment after Monsanto agreed to let me test drive its new leaves, things certainly look new and different. After digging two shallow trenches in my vegetable garden and lining them with compost, I untied the purple mesh bag of seed potatoes Monsanto had sent and opened the grower's guide tied around its neck. Potatoes, you will recall from kindergarten experiments, are grown not from actual seeds, but from the eyes of other potatoes, and the dusty, stone-colored chunks of tuber I carefully laid at the bottom of the trench looked much like any other. Yet the grower's guide that comes with them put me in mind not so much of planting vegetables as booting up a new software release. By opening and using this product, the card informed me, I was now licensed to grow these potatoes, but only for a single generation. The crop I would water and tend and harvest was mine, yet also not mine. That is, the potatoes I would dig come September would be mine to eat or sell, but their genes would remain the intellectual property of Monsanto, protected under several U.S. patents. Were I to save even one of these spuds to plant next year, something I've routinely done with my potatoes in the past, I would be breaking federal law. I had to wonder what would be the legal status of any volunteers, those plants that, with no prompting from the gardener, sprout each spring from tubers overlooked during the previous harvest. The small print on the label also brought the disconcerting news that my potato plants were themselves registered as a pesticide with the Environmental Protection Agency. If proof were needed that the food chain that begins with seeds and ends on our dinner plates is in the midst of revolutionary change, the small print that accompanied my new leaves will do. That food chain has been unrivaled for its productivity. On average, an American farmer today grows enough food each year to feed 100 people. Yet that achievement, that power over nature, has come at a price. The modern industrial farmer cannot grow that much food without large quantities of chemical fertilizers, pesticides, machinery, and fuel. This expensive set of inputs, as they're called, saddles the farmer with debt, jeopardizes his health, erodes his soil and ruins its fertility, pollutes the groundwater, and compromises the safety of the food we eat. Thus, the gain in the farmer's power has been trailed by a host of new vulnerabilities. All this I'd heard before, of course, but always from environmentalists or organic farmers. What is new is to hear the same critique from industrial farmers, government officials, and the agribusiness companies that sold farmers on all those expensive inputs in the first place. Taking a page from Wendell Berry, of all people, Monsanto declared in a recent annual report that current agricultural technology is unsustainable. What is to rescue the American food chain is a new kind of plant. Genetic engineering promises to replace expensive and toxic chemicals with expensive but apparently benign genetic information. Crops that, like my new leaves, can protect themselves from insects and diseases without the help of pesticides. In the case of the new leaf, a gene borrowed from one strain of a common bacterium found in the soil, Bacillus thuringiensis, or BT for short, gives the potato plant's cells the information they need to manufacture a toxin lethal to the Colorado potato beetle. This gene is now Monsanto's intellectual property. With genetic engineering, agriculture has entered the information age, and Monsanto's aim, it would appear, is to become its Microsoft, supplying the proprietary operating systems, the metaphor is theirs, to run this new generation of plants. The metaphors we use to describe the natural world strongly influence the way we approach it, the style and extent of our attempts at control. It makes all the difference in and to the world if one conceives of a farm as a factory or a forest as a farm. Now we're about to find out what happens when people begin approaching the genes of our food plants as software. The Andes, 1532. The patented potatoes I was planting are descended from wild ancestors growing on the Andean Altiplano, the potatoes' center of diversity. It was here that Solanum tuberosum was first domesticated more than 7,000 years ago by ancestors of the Incas. Actually, some of the potatoes in my garden are closely related to those ancient potatoes. Among the half dozen or so different varieties I grow are a couple of ancient heirlooms, including the Peruvian blue potato. This starchy spud is about the size of a golf ball. When you slice it through the middle, the flesh looks as though it had been tie-dyed, the most gorgeous shade of blue. My blue potato is part of the cornucopia of potatoes developed by the Incas along with their ancestors and descendants. In addition to the blue potato, the Incas grew reds, pinks, yellows, and oranges. All manner of skinnies and fatties, smooth skins and russets, short-season spuds and long, drought-tolerant and water-loving, sweet tubers and bitter ones, good for forage, starchy potatoes and others almost buttery in texture. Some 3,000 different spuds in all. This extravagant flowering of potato diversity owes partly to the Incas' desire for variety, partly to their flair for experimentation, and partly to the intricacy of their agriculture, the most sophisticated in the world at the time of the Spanish conquest. While I was waiting for my potatoes to come up that May, I began reading about theirs, and then those of the Irish, hoping to get a clearer picture of the relationship between people and potatoes, and how that relationship had changed both the plant and ourselves. The Incas figured out how to grow impressive yields of potatoes under the most inauspicious conditions, developing an approach that is still in use in parts of the Andes today. A more or less vertical habitat prevents special challenges to both plants and their cultivators, because the microclimate changes dramatically with every change in altitude or orientation to the sun and wind. A potato that thrives on one side of a ridge at one altitude will languish in another plot only a few steps away. No monoculture could succeed under such circumstances, so the Incas developed a method of farming that is monoculture's exact opposite. Instead of betting the farm on a single cultivar, the Andean farmer, then as now, made a great many bets, at least one for every ecological niche. Instead of attempting, as most farmers do, to change the environment to suit a single optimal spud, the russet Burbank say, the Incas developed a different spud for every environment. To Western eyes, the resulting farms look patchy and chaotic. The plots are discontinuous, a little of this growing here, a little of that over there, offering none of the familiar Apollonian satisfactions of an explicitly ordered landscape. Yet the Andean potato farm represented an intricate ordering of nature that, unlike Versailles in 1999, say, or Ireland in 1845, can withstand virtually anything nature is apt to throw at it. Since the margins and hedgerows of the Andean farm were, and still are, populated by weedy wild potatoes, the farmers' cultivated varieties have regularly crossed with their wild relatives, in the process refreshing the gene pool and producing new hybrids. Whenever one of these new potatoes proves its worth, surviving a drought or storm, say, or winning praise at the dinner table, it is promoted from the margins to the fields and, in time, to the neighbors' fields as well. Artificial selection is thus a continual local process, each new potato the product of an ongoing back and forth between the land and its cultivators, mediated by the universe of all possible potatoes, the species genome. The genetic diversity cultivated by the Incas and their descendants is an extraordinary cultural achievement and a gift of incalculable value to the rest of the world. A free and unencumbered gift, one might add, quite unlike my patented and trademarked New Leafs. Intellectual property is a recent Western concept that means nothing to a Peruvian farmer then or now. In fact, intellectual property has been defined under recent trade agreements in such a way as to specifically exclude any innovations that are not the private, marketable property of an individual or corporation. Thus, a corporation's new potato qualifies as intellectual property, but not a tribe's. Of course, Francisco Pizarro was looking for neither plants nor intellectual property when he conquered the Incas. He had eyes only for gold. None of the conquistadors could have imagined it, but the funny-looking tubers they encountered high in the Andes would prove to be the single most important treasure they would bring back from the New World. May 15th. After several days of drenching rain, the sun appeared this week, and so did my new leaves. A dozen deep green shoots pushed up out of the soil and commenced to grow, faster and more robustly than any of my other potatoes. Apart from their vigor, though, my new leaves looked perfectly normal. They certainly didn't beep or glow, as a few visitors to my garden jokingly inquired. Not that the glowing notion is so far-fetched. I've read that plant breeders have developed a luminescent tobacco plant by inserting a gene from a firefly. I've yet to read why they would do this, except perhaps to prove it could be done. A demonstration of power. Yet, as I watched my new leaves multiply their lustrous, dark green leaves those first few days, eagerly awaiting the arrival of the first unwitting beetle, I couldn't help thinking of them as existentially different from the rest of my plants. All domesticated plants are in some sense artificial, living archives of both cultural and natural information that people have helped to design. Any given type of potato reflects the human desires that have been bred into it. One that's been selected to yield long, handsome French fries or unblemished round potato chips is the expression of a national food chain and a culture that likes its potatoes highly processed. At the same time, some of the more delicate European fingerlings growing beside my new leaves imply an economy of small-market growers and a cultural taste for eating potatoes fresh, for none of these varieties can endure much travel or time in storage. I'm not sure exactly what cultural values to ascribe to my Peruvian blues. Perhaps nothing more than a craving for variety among a people who ate potatoes morning, noon, and night. "Tell me what you eat," Anselme Briand-Savarin famously claimed, "and I will tell you what you are." The qualities of a potato, as of any domesticated plant or animal, are a fair reflection of the values of the people who grow and eat it. Yet all these qualities already existed in the potato, somewhere within the universe of genetic possibilities presented by the species Solanum tuberosum. And though that universe may be vast, it is not infinite. Since unrelated species in nature cannot be crossed, the breeder's art has always run up against a natural limit of what a potato is willing or able to do. That species' essential identity. Nature has always exercised a kind of veto over what culture can do with a potato. Until now. The new leaf is the first potato to override that veto. Monsanto likes to depict genetic engineering as just one more chapter in the ancient history of human modifications of nature, a story going back to the discovery of fermentation. The company defines the word biotechnology so broadly as to take in the brewing of beer, cheesemaking, and selective breeding. All are technologies that involve the manipulation of life forms. Yet this new biotechnology has overthrown the old rules governing the relationship of nature and culture in a plant. Domestication has never been a simple one-way process in which our species has controlled others. Other species participate only so far as their interests are served, and many plants, such as the oak, simply sit the whole game out. That game is the one Darwin called artificial selection, and its rules have never been any different from the rules that govern natural selection. The plant, in its wildness, proposes new qualities, and then man, or in the case of natural selection, nature, selects which of those qualities will survive and prosper. But about one rule, Darwin was emphatic. As he wrote in The Origin of Species, man does not actually produce variability. Now he does. For the first time, breeders can bring qualities at will from anywhere in nature into the genome of a plant. From fireflies, the quality of luminescence. From flounders, frost tolerance. From viruses, disease resistance. And in the case of my potatoes, from the soil bacterium known as Bacillus thuringiensis. Never in a million years of natural or artificial selection would these species have proposed those qualities. Modification by descent has been replaced by something else. Now, it is true that genes occasionally move between species. The genome of many species appears to be somewhat more fluid than scientists used to think.